Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
On Friday, October 16th, the Norris Group proudly presents its 8th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts will join Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. Proceeds for the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This event would not be possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: Housing Wire, Property Radar, the Apartment Owners Association, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, San Jose Real Estate Investors Association, Invest Club for Women, MVT Productions, and White House Catering. For tickets and information, visit isurvivedrealestate.com.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Christopher Thornburg. Dr. Thornburg is founding partner of Beacon Economics, LLC, and widely considered to be one of the nation's leading economists, an expert in economic forecasting, regional economics, labor markets, economic policy, and industry and real estate analysis. He was one of the earliest and most adamant predictors of the subprime mortgage market collapse and of the global economic recession that followed. In 2015, Dr. Thornburg was named to California State Treasury John Chiang's Council of Economic Advisors. He also serves on the advisory boards of Paulson & Company, Inc., one of Wall Street's leading hedge funds, and of the Los Angeles Area Chamber of Commerce, Southern California's largest not-for-profit business federation. Recently, he was appointed as executive director of the Center for Forecasting and Economic Development at the UC Riverside School of Business Administration. The new center is hosting a major event, the Inland Southern California Economic Forecast Conference, on October 1st at the Riverside Convention Center. Chris will be presenting a new forecast for the global and U.S. economy at the conference, which will also include a forecast for California and the inland regions of Southern California. Christopher, welcome to our show once again.
Great to be here, Bruce.
One of the things that's always confused me and kept me busy checking out my own answers is that economists looking at exactly the same charts can come to very different conclusions. Why is that?
Well, I'll start by saying economists are people too, and I think that a lot of economists may be swayed by their own personal biases.
That's what I was really getting at is that in a way there's a school of thought or a bent. At sometimes when you get taught a certain way, you look at a chart and it's hard to divert from that vision, if you will. That makes sense to me.
Look, I'm not going to sit here and throw stones. I find myself doing it all the time too. You know, we have specific benchmarks in the world that we set up. It helps us navigate, if you will, and understand what's going on around us. Too often, it means that we also take what we call intellectual shortcuts. We don't really investigate what we're seeing to the full depth we should. We rely on our not so conventional wisdom, shall we say, and that can lead to bad outcomes.
One of the tough things about forecasting nowadays would be certainly almost everything's either in print or recorded, so it's hard to escape what you say.
Yeah, exactly. At some level, there's no doubt about it, and of course, the press seems to go out of their way to take the places where economists do disagree and really trumpet those. You know, the old joke is that, you know, you take any two economists and you'll have five opinions. But when you really dig in, you'll actually find that there's more agreement among economists than you might think. It's just that some of these really high-end issues, anything from tax policy to social policy, where there's a lot of politics involved, then the disagreements become, I think, magnified beyond their true level.
I think sometimes, too, that there's economists that are employed by certain groups where it would be very difficult to maybe state what they feel might be true as opposed to the standard line. And that's hard.
are you saying there's some economists out there who might be biased by their paycheck? No, say it ain't so.
Yeah, occasionally I have run across that. When you looked at 2015, let's say from January or December of 2014, what's been different in the outcome than you might have expected?
Not much. I think that things are pretty much on track with where we expected to be right now. I think the biggest surprise is externally. And let me explain. So domestically, we had a worse weak first quarter. Well, that's the fourth week first quarter in a row. Seems to be part of the data as the case. Maybe people are partying harder on Christmas and they're waking up on Q1 with a much worse Christmas hangover as the case may be. With that aside, consumer spending's bouncing back. You have residential real estate, which is bouncing back. Business investment continues to tick forward. The public sector continues to be a drag on the economy. So most everything we expected has been happening. I think that the two bits of things that are happening out there that kind of throw everything for a loop, one would be oil, which is, of course, continues to fall in terms of its price, and in the short term having distinct negative consequences for some industries, although ultimately this is going to end up being very positive for the United States. And then, of course, the big thing out there has to do with the what's happening in those foreign markets, which I think is defined a lot by the fact that the trade deficit began to open and the dollar is going up. Although, what people don't really appreciate is that those are two completely different things. The dollar is going up vis-a-vis the euro because of European Central Bank policy, but the real problems in the trade deficit are with China. And China right now, as people are starting to recognize, is in a midst of an economic slowdown, and that does, I think, bode ill for particularly the Asian economy, something we all have to keep an eye on.
So China having a rougher time and starting to devalue their currency, how does that impact the U.S. economy?
Well, it's funny because a lot of people have been going on about this devaluation. Remember, they devalued 3%.
Right, as opposed to
the 16 or 17% increase in the dollar vis-a-vis the euro,
right,
or the 10, 12% against many other Asian currencies. There's nothing in that number that means change, because that's way too small of a shift to really mean much of anything. It's the symbolic aspect of it that's really important. Look, when the dollar started appreciating, China's initial goal was, look, we want to be another reserve currency, and damn it, if the dollar's going up, we're going up. And they actually started, believe it or not, selling their foreign reserves. Their foreign reserves were falling for 8 months as they endeavored to support the yuan against the dollar, I think for this purpose of making them more internationally acceptable. But what's trumped that is the ongoing clear indications of slowdown in the Chinese economy. I don't care what the Chinese economists are saying. They did not grow 7% in the first quarter of the year. Retail sales continue to slow. Real estate continues to slow. Auto sales are down. Industrial production is growing the slowest pace since the middle of the Great Recession. All the indicators are that China is hitting a big bump in the road, and they don't know what to do about it. And this new change on the exchange rate reflects the fact that they are suddenly starting to, if you will, examine other options to stabilize their economy. I hope they do. We don't need a China collapsing on us right now. It's a world economy is already wobbly as it is without this secondary influence. But we'll see. I mean, there's a lot of issues over there, and they're going to have to deal with them.
Is there a correlation between the Japanese economy of the 80s, stock market boom, real estate boom, money ran over here to buy stuff, China's stock market boomed and now has receded, and you have real estate prices in Beijing, let's say it's gone up maybe a multiple of 15 times.
Yeah.
So you have a lot of money that's floated around, but I'm not sure any of the price levels actually are real.
Yeah, no, there's no correlation. It's a great point, and I know people have been making it, so I'm glad you brought it up. The difference is completely, it's very absolute. Look, the bubble that was happening in Japan was enormous. I mean, beyond the charts, what's happening in China by a good margin. Really to the point where I think I've heard numbers that, you know, one point in time, Tokyo was worth by itself was worth like, you know, a third of the half the developed world or something insane like that. And they took that funny money and they spread it all over the place. When it all blew up, they ended up with these legions of failed banks that were kind of these zombie banks, and they just all sorts of problems, and their economy is still trying to get over that. That's completely different than China. What China is happening in China is not a financial phenomenon. Yes, the collapse of the stock market has made big news, but, you know, candidly, the stock market over there relative to the size of the economy is tiny. And most of the folks who've gotten in that kind of pushed it up is the last 6 to 12 months. It's not a long-term endemic situation the way it is here. In fact, some folks argue that while things are slowing down in the real estate front, there's really no indication of any kind of major bubble over there. If you look at it from credit or even the value of real estate compared to incomes, nothing suggests there's anything particularly that out of whack in those particular markets. So it doesn't look like on that front. Here's the other side of it. There's another big difference between China and Japan is that when Japan was going through that, Japan was a developed economy with institutions, with systems and rule of law. It is a developed economy. China is not. They don't have rule of law. Corruption is still enormous. They still have a massive proportion of the population which lives in dire poverty. Yes, I know Shanghai is incredibly nice. An hour and a half outside of Shanghai, you're still running into, you know, what we would consider to be third world living at best. And on top of all that, they're starting to hit the point by which the lack of trustable of institutions has really started to have an impact on their economy. So it's a different sort of issue. It's an economy that, if you will, needs to grow up. And there's going to have to be some growing pains to get there. They're going to have to start instituting rule of law, not rule of Communist Party cronies, as the case may be. They're going to have to start enforcing property rights. They're going to have to give dissenters a voice. Mm-hmm. And these sort of processes don't come easy, but unfortunately, if they really want to go to the next level of development, these are the things that have to be done.
I think what you touched on in China, and there's just obviously a smaller problem here, wealth discrepancy. You talk about that in your presentations about that existing in the United States in a kind of an exaggerated way that maybe it hasn't in the last few decades. So talk about our problem and that and how we solve that and the ramifications for kind of having it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, look, we know we have a growing inequality problem in the U.S. Inequality has always been with us, right? But it's becoming more extreme, the differences between the have and the have-nots. A basic statistic is, you know, the top 10% of Americans 25 years ago had maybe 65% of the economy, owned 60% of all assets. Say it's well over 70% and climbing pretty rapidly. Those kind of numbers, the wealth inequality, the gaps between the people with the education and in the right jobs and in the right company, just making just money hand over fist, and then there are people who are still, if you will, casualties of the Great Recession who've never fully made themselves whole again. Now, the way to deal with that, and what's interesting is how you deal with it is not all that complicated, but the political logjam is making it very complicated. And what ends up happening is the lack of good policy at the federal level is leading to what I call the creation of bad policy at the local level. And here's a classic example, the minimum wage. The minimum wage as a tool to reduce poverty, to help people in the lower income stratas kind of make themselves whole and get enough income to really rise to the next level, it has never been proven to be terribly effective at those particular goals. It just hasn't. It doesn't say we shouldn't have some minimum wage. I'm fine with that. But for the most part, it's not a good tool for dealing with inequality. It's not a good tool for dealing with poverty. It's got all sorts of potential problems with it. It's a very a broad tax with a very limited hit. And in general, it's, you know, not a big deal. Now, to deal with this at the federal level, you don't look at the federal minimum wage. You got to do things like the earned income tax credit. obvious sort of things, dealing more with education, various sorts of other social reforms. I mean, there's lots of things you do to help the problem, but none of that's getting done in D.C. And as a result of that, we have cities starting to enact these high minimum wages.
Right.
Well, that's a bad answer to a bad problem. And you're only making the situation worse. And by the way, this is a perfect metaphor for what's wrong with growing inequality. Because what ends up happening is you create a situation by which either the far right is enacting bad policies or the far left is enacting bad policies, because that's where the centers of power are in the midst of this kind of growing inequality. And you know, it's, you know, Ted Cruz and Elizabeth Warren have equally bad answers for what ills our world, if you will. And the idea of pushing money and political power and wealth to the middle is you get rid of that effect. In the middle, you can compromise. In the middle, there are obvious things you can do. And it, like so many problems in our economy today, this is so obvious. Again, earned income tax credits, housing policies, more policies for helping lower echelon students get into universities with various sorts of public support. Most important, just basic education reform, particularly in the inner city, to get the best teachers in there to deal with those students, to give that generation a chance their parents never had. Isn't difficult.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We have the internet. The best teacher could show up on the internet and teach a million people across everywhere in the country. I find it interesting that that probably isn't going to happen as soon as it could, because it would affect and have such a negative economic effect on college campuses.
Oh, come on, Bruce. You don't really believe that, do you?
Yeah, I do believe that.
Disruptive technologies, especially disruptive technologies regarding the internet, will break down those barriers faster than any bureaucrat can possibly put up. I mean, look, I thought the taxi unions were untouchable. I really did. I thought the taxi unions could never have that local monopoly broken. They're so powerful. And Uber ran over them in 2 years. Like I've never seen.
Okay.
So I don't buy that. You know, here's the issue. In the end, teaching is still a human-to-human experience. You look, when I'm teaching somebody, when I'm teaching a class, I've been in there, I've been in the classroom, I've been in group front of group students, and I know where I am. The conversation flows, it ebbs, we converse, we interact with each other. I can see their eyes, I can see the look of confusion, or on those wonderful rare instances, when their eyes light up in understanding, I know where I stand. No computer is ever going to figure that out, at least not in the next 10, 15 years, because there's a degree of human interaction there that the internet can't do. You can't do this stuff watching online videos. You got to be in the room with them. There's got to be give and take, and we just haven't gotten there yet. So it still boils down to the teacher.
Okay. All right, got 5 minutes. Let's talk a little bit about real estate. Construction really still kind of flat on its back. As far as single-family construction in California, it's come up a little bit, but it's still 80% down. What do you feel is the cause of that?
Well, I don't think it's down. I think it's bouncing back. You know, look at the numbers. Last year, the market sagged because the investors pulled back. You know, there was a huge arbitrage play. People made that play. And then when the foreclosures were gone and there was less money to be made, when a lot of folks realized that trying to manage a giant portfolio of single-family homes for rent, not the easiest thing in the world, you add it all up and you realize, this isn't quite the same great deal I was. And so they backed off. And it took a while for the retail buyer to get in. But that's what we're seeing now, more retail buyers. It's a slow recovery we're in. But prices are going up. There is more. And look, new home sales, still pathetically low, but still up 20% from a year ago. Existing home sales have hit a new high. Probably when they announced the numbers, almost assuredly, for July, existing home sales will be the highest they've been since pre-real estate meltdown. So the market is clearly moving in the right direction. But it's just really slow because of the fact that credit is still unbelievably tight. And, you know, again, I hate to keep beaten on this drum, but the law of unintended consequences is so forgotten over and over and over again at policymaking levels. All the folks that came in there and, you know, pointed at the banks and said, "You're evil, and all these poor borrowers over there are victims, and as a result of that, we're going to put all these new rules on you." And they put all these new rules in the banks, and the banks can no longer lend to those people. And those folks who were so harmed through this last go-around, who could have gone out, borrowed money, jumped back in the market, and by golly, this time they probably would have made good money on it because they were buying at the right time, well, all those people have been excluded from this recovery. And the only thing it does is created even a worse problem in inequality, because the people who are able to jump into the market, take advantage of this good affordability, who can get these low interest rates, are people who already have money and have a high credit score. In a sense, they're hurting the exact people they wanted to help.
Yeah, I really agree with that, actually. I don't know why they handled it quite the way they did, but you're exactly right. At a time where we have the lowest interest rates and we had things on sale, and they could have sold it to the group of people that would now have equity and be part of the society in a way they've never had before, they didn't do that. And now the disparity of wealth, that's one of the biggest factors of disparity. If you look at somebody that's retired, you know, the guy that's worth 25 grand or worth 250, do they own a house? Because where the poverty is where they don't own a house.
Yeah, now we got to be a little cautious about causality there. I don't think that owning a house necessarily makes you, you know, wealthy, but clearly it's symptomatic of a person who, by virtue of their life choices, is in a much better position. And certainly buying a home is a good life choice, and it's something we should be encouraging at some level and making sure people can get an opportunity to, particularly when the market was so underpriced as it was there for a while. I mean, think of it. They got all those people mortgages who lost their homes in the first place. They all could have gone out and bought homes at these nice low prices. They would have helped the market recover. They would have helped recover themselves. That would have been a win-win. But instead, we are where we are, which is a housing market that's still languishing and candidly still a bit of an anchor on the U.S. economy.
Yep, and it's unless they change some lending policies. Last 40 seconds, hedge funds participation. Are they going to be market makers as they exit?
I don't think so. I think that they are just riding it, and I think that when the retail market starts coming back strongly, yeah, I think they'll start selling off units into it. Well, why wouldn't you, right? You can make some money. You're pulling your cash off the table slowly but surely. But I don't think anybody has any particular incentive, not in this market, to just dump everything. I mean, why would you? Home prices are still going up faster than interest rates by a good margin, right? So
right.
It's still a good investment, no matter how you look at it.
Christopher,
so I don't see any reason why they would dump it.
We've run out of time. Always enjoy talking with you, and I'll look forward to our meeting in October.
Looking forward to it, Bruce, and we're really glad to have you on board. You're going to be a great part of that event, and hopefully all the future events as well.
Thank you very much.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate, Adrenaline Athletics, Coachella Valley Real Estate Investors Association, Coldwell Banker Town & Country, Elite Auctions, iMortgage, In A Day Development, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, IRA Services Trust Company, Jennifer Buys Houses, Keller Williams Corona, Keystone CPA, Las Brisas Escrow, LA South RIA, Lavis Tax Wealth Management, New Western Acquisition, North California Real Estate Investors Association, North San Diego Real Estate Investors, Pilot Limousine, Orange County Phoebe, Real Wealth Network, Realty 411 Magazine, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Southern California Chapter of the Appraisal Institute, Sonoka Corporation, Spinnaker Loans, Tri-Counties Association of Realtors, UDirect IRA Services, Wilson Investment Properties, and Westin South Coast Plaza. To find out more about the event, visit isurvivedrealestate.com.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show.
For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.